We're rolling. Hey, this is Mark Goldberg with the United Nations Affairs blog, UN Dispatch.
And this is Matthew Lee from Inner City Press at the UN.
So you're reporting from the UN, and big news at the UN today, Matthew. War is breaking out in South Ossetia.
I would say
why don't you take it from there?
Sure. I would actually say, I would say war has broken out. There have been two meetings now. Both held on an emergency basis. Last night, so we're recording this on Friday, whatever, 7 p.m., but on Thursday, around almost 24 hours ago, an email went out to the journalists and to others saying an 11 p.m. emergency meeting of the Security Council called by Russia. So that was kind of about what they called Georgia's, illegal assault on the breakaway region of South Ossetia, which broke away from Georgia in like 92, still is part of Georgia in everyone's eyes, including Russia's, but has governed itself since 92 entirely by itself and is very much supported by Russia, including militarily.
And it's majority sort of ethnic Russian as well.
That's true. There's actually a South Ossetia. I mean, they claim that they have their own ethnic group as well. But we'll get into that. One of Georgia's claims is that the basis of their separatism is really that there's Russians and that there's some of these are kind of carpetbaggers that are previously fighters in Chechnya and Afghanistan. There's a lot of allegations flowing. But there is. I mean, this is one of the rare, not a rare one, but it's sort of like last night seemed sort of comical in the sense of like there was fighting, but it's gotten much worse in the last like 12 hours. There's definitely like bombing taking place even outside of the what they call the zone of conflict. So the fact that the council, I mean, we can parse it out, but the fact that they've met now for midnight last night until 2 in the morning, today from 3 until now, and have not been able to agree on a 3-sentence press statement calling for a ceasefire is, to many people's eyes, symptomatic of a problem with the structure of the Security Council.
So where do the sort of the differences break down?
Sure. The in a way, I think when I inevitably look at it this way. Last night, when Russia called this emergency meeting, they hadn't yet circulated a statement. But when they came out with it, it was so short that most people thought, like, okay, this can be done. 3 sentences. I'm going to once again, for purposes of the viewer, maybe it'll be visible. Press statement, 3 sentences, unless you're kind of steeped in either Security Council lore or the South Ossetia conflict, it all seemed pretty straightforward. It was going to express concern at the escalation of violence. It was going to call on the parties to the conflict to cease bloodshed without delay and to renounce the use of force. This, as it turns out, was the main sticking point, this final phrase, renouncing the use of force.
Yeah.
And interestingly, I mean, I think a lot of I've actually watched CNN during the day, and it's very much portrayed as like the new Cold War, Russia cracking down on previous parts of the Soviet Union, which may be part of it, but people should be very clear that in terms of the Security Council part of it, it was Georgia, the U.S., the U.K., and France that were unable last night to live with this phrase, renounce the use of force. They refused to agree to it. Russia said it must be in, and therefore nothing took place. Go ahead.
And they argue that that sort of unfairly sort of prevents sort of the Georgians from defending themselves against sort of Russian aggression.
I'll tell you what's strange about it, honestly, because I having stayed till 2 in the morning, the reason I did was to be able to ask just that question of the French ambassador and the Georgian ambassador. They really don't actually publicly explain why they're against that phrase. And in fact, when you push them, the French ambassador last night said, well, we are for the cessation of the use of force. It's very hard to understand because if you think, I mean, my one joke you could make is that by joining the UN, you to some degree agree to renounce the use of force unless authorized by the council, right?
Sure.
And that's part of what you're doing. But what it is that, this is the flip side. During Russia is very much viewed as sort of the protector of these two breakaway zones in Georgia. And they've been publicly for about the last year, maybe longer, but for a year that I've seen, been calling on Georgia to sign and commit in writing to not use force to retake the two areas. And I think, in a way, it makes sense when you say, like, commit not to use force, it sounds nice. From Georgia's point of view, and I think in this, really, the U.S., U.K., and France are just, they just are carrying Georgia's water. They support Georgia. So if Georgia says we don't sign, and the reason they don't want to sign it is that that's their main leverage against the breakaway area, is that they retain, you know, the ability to retake it by force. It's sort of like what they tried to say last night, Georgia, is that they would only commit to renounce the use of force as part of a negotiation. meaning if the two breakaway zones committed to stop, to not break away, to accepting autonomy but remaining with Georgia, then maybe they could commit not to use force. But to say we won't use force is just, from their point of view, just inviting the zones to say, great, that's off the table, now when do we get independence, like Kosovo? And that's really, that's why I think this is going to be fertile ground for us, is that this is the echo to Kosovo is deafening.
Now here's the question. Why, so if North Abkhazia and South Ossetia have been sort of breakaway provinces of Georgia since 1992, why all of a sudden is the Georgian army moving on South Ossetia? Why today?
No, well, it's been kind of brewing, and I won't also. I mean, I think that the escalation, to be fair, has been sort of on both sides. But I would, one, if we want to tie it to Kosovo, we can say this: we can say that after Kosovo declared independence earlier this year, and 40 some countries have since recognized it, both Abkhazia and South Ossetia renewed their declarations of independence, and no one really paid it much mind. In a way, it's strange. I understand that the history behind Kosovo is different and the interest of EU powers. But it's sort of strange. It must be strange if you are a, South Ossetian or Abkhaz nationalist that you can declare independence having governed yourself since 92 and have no one pay you any mind. Except Russia, which said, we're not going to recognize it, but they're going to increase their bilateral relations with the territory. And this drove Georgia crazy. They said, you can't, because Georgia keeps saying, this is our territory. Again, you can't help but think, like, this is what Serbia said about Kosovo, but nobody cared then, right?
Right.
And I guess you get down to this argument, which I've heard people make kind of off the record, never on camera, is that, Serbia acted so badly they lost the right to Kosovo. And Georgia hasn't been thought to act as badly. Now they're today, and I've really tried to listen to both sides, so it really is kind of cognitive dissonance. But there are some people describing that Georgia shelled the capital of South Ossetia, which I'm going to challenge you to say the name of, Mark. Go ahead.
Oh, you can't do that.
I'm going to mispronounce it. I'm going to call it Chicken Valley. Chicken Valley, but you.
I would have said the same thing.
Okay, we can agree to call it Chicken Valley. It has a different name. It's, people may have seen on the news. It's like Sin Valley. Everyone, even
there's
Tbilisi.
A lot of consonants pushed right together.
I can say
and not
Sukhumi.
Very many vowels.
Sukhumi is the capital of Abkhazia. It's easier to say, and it's. But the thing to under. It's a pretty small. It's a small area, so that's what sort of.
Yeah.
It's not just that the council had meetings, but meeting at 11 till 2 in the morning is rare. It's even since I've been here, it's rare. So sometimes they'll do the weekend, but like beginning at 11 p.m. is out of the norm. And today, I want to just the drama of it. At today's meeting, they actually did a second, which is pretty rare, public meeting, meaning like all 15 members, and then Georgia was allowed to sit at the table. And basically, the two main speakers were Ambassador Churkin of Russia and Ambassador Alassania of Georgia. And they, as last night, they sort of traded charges. But then, out of the blue, Ambassador Alassania of Georgia said, I have just received a call from my foreign minister, and I must inform you that Russian jets have begun bombing Abkhazia, or the Kadori Gorge, which is right next to it.
Yeah, that's been reported in the media today as well.
It has, but the one thing is, they're now saying at the UN that the UN has not yet confirmed this bombing of Abkhazia, and they do have there's like a peacekeeping or political mission there. So that there's actually probably going to be Security Council tomorrow, believe it or not. But this was the moment that people said they hadn't seen since 62. One diplomat I spoke to said, not since, the U.S. and Russia about Cuba had he seen this. Instead of just trading speeches back and forth, the Georgian ambassador said, pointing at Churkin, the jets are in the air. When are you going to stop them? And there's really no provision in the Security Council for, like, back and forth. It's sort of like, we give the floor to X, and usually, he gives a speech. There's sort of a way you can say, like, well, as my distinguished colleague said, but you never have, like, somebody pointing their finger at somebody else and saying, are you going to stop killing people? Yes or no,
Yeah.
And the funny
thing.
And
what was the response?
He actually didn't respond to that. He called it grandstanding and said, everyone's for peace. This is Churkin's, the Russian said, everyone's for peace, but you can't just have slogans. I mean, I think there's really a lot to be said here because at any point, even in the last 24 hours, if you take a snapshot, depending on when you take it, one side or the other can look right,
Yeah. Well, sort of initially, you had. the Georgian army moving on sort of South Ossetia at the same time. You know, this is not necessarily a crime. It's their own territory. You know, the sort of international crime, to the extent it happened when Russia violated Georgian territory.
Although,
but like you said, I think, you know, both sides are definitely at fault here, and restraint is probably, you know, in everyone's best interests. What sort of strikes me as interesting here is, you know, not long ago we had talk of Georgia perhaps entering NATO.
Yep.
Just like imagine right now if a NATO country was
they were
at
on
war
the hook
with
for
Russia,
sure.
would we in the United States be at the brink of nuclear war? You know, it's sort of a scary proposition. I, for one, am frankly glad that Georgia never got NATO membership.
Although there are people, no, absolutely. I think a lot of people are saying that this seals the deal, at least for a while, because nobody wants to be on the hook. And I think especially, well, to me what will be interesting is that even though they were rebuffed, at least for now, joining NATO, they definitely, they unequivocally have the support of the quote, the Western powers, the U.S.,
sure.
You know, UK and France are. It's not even that. I mean, it's almost like they'll adopt almost seemingly absurd positions if that's what Georgia wants. I.e., Georgia doesn't want to commit to renounce the use of force, even though publicly it's hard to say why you won't agree to that. They just say we support you, you know. And then the code word is we must support the territorial integrity of Georgia. And you know, I mean, as you know, this was the phrase with Serbia. Serbia was like, what about our territorial integrity? But you know. Things move on, but I think when you kind of get into it, it's kind of like what it's, you know, I saw President Shakashvili of Georgia. He was on various TV stations today. I mean, he must have spent all day in his own little kind of like presidential broadcasting suite, because the same flag. He was on BBC, Al Jazeera, CNN, and in each place he accused Russia of starting this. He said Russia chose the time of the Olympics to start this, and it's like, I mean, it's difficult from here. I have to say for it from all, but when you really look at it, Georgia.
It was Georgia that sort of started this current row. Yeah. You know, I think that's pretty, you know, indisputable, right?
I know, except that the problem is you have the president of Georgia doesn't say it that way. He said,
well, of course not.
Exactly. And the fact is, I think if you look at the media coverage, I mean, I didn't see. I was so much down at the Security Council stakeout. I can't say that I watched like an hour of each, you know, major network. But the CNN one, I didn't see any. I didn't see the other side. I saw it very much portrayed as like Russian tanks moving into former, you know.
Yeah.
And
it's weird because you know, CNN has been portraying it all day that way, as if it was sort of Russia making the first move.
Right.
But you know, that's sort of clearly not the case.
No, exactly. And it's sort of, I mean, actually, I asked one of the CNN, this is just a sort of UN aside, but I asked one of the CNN people here, and he's like, well, you know, we are based in Georgia. Just, you know, whatever.
Yeah, so, well.
But okay, all right. But I mean, that was. But it was. I mean, I think the. I mean, obviously, the politics at work here. Everything came down. And this is also like the reason I read out that sentence is like the sentence: the members of the Security Council call on the parties to the conflict to cease bloodshed. Even that was a problem. And why was it a problem? Because the Western powers wanted it to change to call on all parties. Like by saying they say that saying the parties. It's only getting Georgia to tie a hand behind its back. So they want to make it clear that this is a call on Russia to stop, right?
Yeah.
And the whole thing is like now, I mean, what's unclear on the ground is has Georgia actually managed to reclaim at least part of this breakaway area? And even if there's a ceasefire announced, do they get to keep it? I mean, it's sort of like if a thing is only a sort of a, you know, possession is 9/10 of the law. If your claim to independence is just that you're a de facto breakaway republic, when even in violation of agreements, because that's the thing, maybe they didn't violate international law, but there were agreements this wasn't supposed to happen. If you just reclaim half of it, and then you declare a ceasefire, probably you get to keep it. All right? Who's going to say, go back? You know, give it back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I assume, sir, you know, what's the end game, you know, here? Presumably, do you think actually the Security Council will authorize some sort of peacekeeping mission in there? I know there's already one. There's already like a small political observer mission.
Sure.
Do you think they'll expand that at all?
I don't know if the UN. It's hard for with the UN number one being so understaffed in Darfur and not even being able to get to first base in terms of doing one in Somalia. I know probably there are countries that would contribute to a UN mission in Georgia that wouldn't contribute to either of the other two.
Right.
I think most people think like, and actually, right at the end of this process, where it was like, totally deflating. Like the new, I have to say this: the president of the council for the month of August is from Belgium, and he's just not that helpful. He just sort of said,
"Really,
we will continue, you know, tomorrow." And then as people tried to ask him questions, he just floated away from the microphone. The analogy is like a balloon. If you let go of the string, he didn't even run away. He just sort of floated away. And even like last month we had Vietnam, and he grew on the journalists. Like, you got to answer questions. But then the French ambassador or deputy ambassador came out, and he said something very strange, which is that not strange or noteworthy, that, well, you know, as France is the president of the EU currently, they're doing everything possible through the OSCE and other regional bodies. So I think that the peace, you know, maybe this, he almost was implying, go ahead.
Yeah.
I know, I use a lot of acronyms.
Isn't the problem there that sort of the OSCE countries, you know, which is like a group of basically Western European economic powers, are sort of pro Georgia? They wouldn't necessarily be seen as impartial, right?
That's exactly. But the other thing is, but I will say, I'm actually, because I'm looking at it, I'm usually, it's not a question of taking Russia's side. I just think like they don't really get properly covered in the media, and it does when you have three of the right. I mean, here's just another aside. Normally these days, certainly on Zimbabwe and on some other things, you had like France, UK, and the US on one side, and China and Russia hanging tough on the other side. Oh, we actually should say something about Zimbabwe, but that's the current split on the council. And it's a lot of people say it's paralyzing, some people say it's interesting, but on this, China's only comment last night at about 1:30 in the morning, when it was their turn to speak. Even Vietnam praised Russia and said, you know, we congratulate our Russian brothers, sort of. China's just said, you know, we wish that both sides would obey the Olympic truce. I mean, it's really,
exactly. I mean,
it's incredible.
That's the other thing. I mean, you know, I've seen some speculation in the media that Georgia decided to, you know, start this spat because of the, you know, because
one
you
of
use the
P5
Olympics
is,
as a pretext.
Sure.
Everyone is distracted by the Olympics, and maybe, you know, they assume that there would be sort of the international community would come down quick and hard to stop any Russian counterattack and counter-aggression.
No, I actually think, I mean, I think, and here's the thing, and obviously neither of us are there, and you sort of like, even like I read a Reuters story, and all it's doing is quoting Georgian government officials. I mean, I think that there's still a danger of like, something is definitely afoot. I mean, there's some, I think eyewitnesses have confirmed that this port of Poti has suffered some hits from the sky. And I think there's also, you know, an aside to all this is that there's this pretty important pipeline that goes through Georgia, and it's unclear if it's been hit. It's definitely British Petroleum stock prices down. So somebody was joking at, you know, I maybe that's not a joke, you know, like resources almost are behind almost all of these conflicts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Except, the person was like, you know, there must be oil in Kosovo. It's like, I'm not sure. Other than the hair, you know, hair gel, maybe. But I mean, this is kind of, people are just whiling away time here. But the facts on the ground. In fact, they give the council gave it as an excuse for not taking action today, that the facts are simply changing too fast. But it's sort of, what a lot of people would say is normally like, there was a coup in Mauritania. It happened this week. A change of power by force of a democratic elected government, and the council didn't issue anything.
Mm-hmm.
This thing, it's like they're going to issue something, but they're treating it like it's like the Magna Carta. It's like it's a resolution. I think they realize, like, normally a press statement, they just whip this stuff off. You know, just say, we call for both sides should, you know, go to their corner. And but I think what they realize here is, like, this, how this is phrased will be pointed to by either side to say, We're right, you know. We get to keep this land, or they should have signed the non-use of force agreement. So it's like, it'll be amazing if they do nothing. I mean, I don't, you know.
I mean, I guess this is what happens when you have a permanent member of the Security Council being sort of one of the, you know, participants in a conflict, and sort of the other members of the Security Council are backing, you know, their opponent.
But the weird thing of just about that phrasing is, like, I mean, I agree. I think that there are some things around the world where only, you know, there's only one country supporting it, and it's sort of like they should. Some people were saying, like, either there should have to be a double veto to have there be a veto, or, you know, maybe as happens in a lot of places, like, you have to recuse yourself from your own conflict. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say. I mean, it may be. I think Russia has some. China probably, if it could emerge from its Olympic stupor, would side with Russia on this one. And I think certainly like Vietnam. I know it sounds like the same, what many people would say is sort of the rogue groups, but when you really kind of look at the I mean, it's a. I think here's what the shame is. I'm not sure what a real fire-breathing, you know, pro-West ideologue would say, but
yeah.
It's sort of like, yeah, basically, it's like they. I guess because they don't like Russia, therefore they like Georgia. Now Georgia closed down the media. Georgia does a lot of things. Georgia's hardly
right.
like a paragon of democracy and freedom
right.
of the press.
I mean, he's our ally, but you know, right. but in many ways, you know, it's sort of like, you know, just another. Semi-autocrat that we, you know, are allied with because we don't like their enemies. We share similar, you know, enemies.
Right. So it's not, I guess it's not, there are a few situations where you can say,
yeah.
like, world opinion is clearly, you know, that something should stop. But
yeah.
one permanent member of the council says, hell no, you know? Maybe even
yeah.
Guantanamo Bay might be that way, to be
yeah.
honest. You know what I mean? I think the Europeans are not, like, maybe some people say that cynically they actually like it and want to send people there. But it seems like if you took a poll, you know, it's pretty
yeah.
widespread. But, you know, what
so,
do you... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So I'm wondering, so what's next? So again, we're recording this Friday night.
Yep.
What can we expect to happen over the weekend?
Well,
and
the council,
what do you see
yeah.
as maybe a resolution?
In terms of the
yeah.
nitty-gritty. And it's
yeah.
not, I mean, again, to be clear, here's the ironic thing. It's not even a resolution. It's a
mm-hmm.
press statement, like, I mean, which makes,
yeah.
number one, only resolutions can actually bind countries to do anything. So,
yeah.
like, you know, when they pass sanctions, if and when they pass the additional sanctions on Iran, it's a resolution, it's under Chapter 7,
yeah.
and it requires
yeah.
countries that don't agree with it to obey with it. One step
yeah.
down is a presidential statement, which everyone has to agree to and is a sort of a presidential document, you know, like with a precedent. A
yeah.
press statement is not, literally, it's just the 15 members agree that the president of the council can come out and read a statement to the press.
Yeah.
So we've been here for two nights, one
till
night
2 a.m.
till 2 in the morning
yeah.
to try. But I think, you know, again, it shows that how, like, this conflict over a relatively small piece of real estate
yeah.
but implicates, it's like U.S. and Russia. And everyone even said,
mm-hmm.
even though the UK and France are also, you know, whatever, on the Georgian side, it's very much U.S. and Russia, and both, you know, Khalilzad, I mean, last night, actually, not only was it not Ambassador Khalilzad the number one, it wasn't the number two Ambassador Wolf, it wasn't, maybe it was number three.
Really?
We don't know. Yeah.
They didn't have the top two U.S. diplomats
in
the UN.
Last night they sent a woman, they sent somebody that no one here had ever seen before. So there was a lot of kind of like joking about
interesting.
It.
Interesting.
We're
okay.
told she's the, you probably, this name, she's the new Jackie Sanders. Who,
oh, okay.
Right? Who's just arrived.
I don't know the new Jackie Sanders.
Yeah. Okay, the old Jackie Sanders was Jackie Sanders, who was a...
She was the representative
yeah.
to the Security Council, right?
No, she was the non-proliferation ring. That's why I threw it this
okay.
way. She was viewed as a kind of a she was like number four, but she was very...
Okay.
Some people said she was a Republican fundraiser, but those people were just being cruel. We don't know who the new person is, but it was sort of striking to have, like, Churkin and, like, you know, like, we always, you know, it's like the first string, the second string, the third string, and then, like, what's
yeah.
this, you know? But
so
today,
I mean, why do you think that happened? I mean, that seems pretty odd.
I know.
You have sort of the top diplomats from the Russian side and presumably the French and British side as well.
I'll go down the line.
And
on the British side was the number two, but it's possible that number one was on vacation. There's a lot of... I think the U.S. one was really striking.
It is August at the U.N.
August at the U.N.
There's a lot of vacation going
in
on.
In fact, Ban Ki-moon
yeah.
himself... Ban Ki-moon himself is going on vacation, I believe, tomorrow. He was
okay.
asked today... He wasn't asked. His spokesperson, Michelle Montes, was asked, what has he done about South Ossetia? And she was like, well, I mean, you know, the Security Council's handling it. So it is kind of strange,
yeah.
actually.
Well, like he did, you know, one thing it seems the UN is doing is sort of keeping focus and attention on the refugee crisis that's being catalyzed by this. There's a couple thousand refugees that have fled from Ossetia into Russia.
Right,
and I did see on the UN site that they were, you know, trying to highlight, you know, that cause.
Well, exactly. I guess here's what I want to say is not to be a cynic, but when I see when the only place I see something is on the UN News Center, I wonder
yeah.
whether it's that the UN is trying to step into this problem, or is trying to like highlight some role that it has in a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Where I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that if normally the idea is like they'll say Ben, he's on the phone, he's speaking to leaders. He got kind
yeah.
of like totally marginalized in this one. I mean, I will here. I'm
isn't
gonna,
that? I mean, again,
right.
isn't it sort of the nature of this particular conflict? Like, it seems that if there was a conflict going on in a non-Security Council member state.
Okay, maybe the stakes are too high.
Or with the Security Council. Or frankly, if it was a weaker, you know, maybe sub-Saharan African state,
right.
the Secretary General, as the Secretary General, has a lot more leverage.
Mm-hmm.
But in this instance, it doesn't seem like he doesn't have that much leverage over Tbilisi, Georgia, or Moscow.
Right, right. No, I guess, and also we can go. I'll throw this one in. Given the way that Kosovo has been playing out, he's not really. I have to say this. I don't think he's that popular with the Russian Foreign Ministry. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's.
Yes.
I think that also may be a part of it. It's not like there's like a lot of goodwill there to call up Sergei Lavrov, the Foreign Minister of Russia, and say, you know, hey. Do me a solid. They'll be like, hey, you know, basically, you screwed us. You screwed us this year. And I think from their point of view, I don't think they think that Ban Ki-moon himself single-handedly could have stopped the Declaration of Independence. But they viewed him as basically siding with it and since then making statements like, well, the UN presence is winding down. And Russia's like, no, it has to, you know, until there's a resolution, you've got to stay there. So there's actually been some, there's been some developments on that front. But, here's the other. Okay. I mean, but again, not to be negative. Since you were on your trip, we can throw that out there. There have been some UN developments where I know. I mean, I understand, like you're saying, like they're trying to do their best. I think, like, here's another thing that took place on the situation in Zimbabwe. I will bet you that certainly by the next time we speak, it's widely thought that this weekend, some type of a power sharing agreement is going to be agreed to. There's a draft. They claim it's very sensitive, but the UN piece of this is that. Ban Ki-moon's envoy to Zimbabwe, which was sort of like the UN's way of saying, okay, there wasn't a sanctions resolution which would have created a new post for the UN to do it, but Ban Ki-moon sent this guy, Haile Menkerios, to be his envoy to the peace talks. He was just barred from going to Zimbabwe.
Hmm.
But interestingly, like today they were asked and they tried to downplay that and say, well, you know, he wasn't really trying to go, but it's reported all over the South African press he wanted to go, and Mugabe basically said, don't come, you know?
Well, there you go.
I don't know.
So does that call into question the likelihood of an impending power sharing agreement?
No, it doesn't at all. Actually, I mean, it's sort of, interestingly, I mean, I guess here's what I'm thinking is like I think like there is the thing about the UN or not even the UN. We can let's cut this much smaller. Is that you were just saying like the Security Council, particularly if a conflict involves one of the permanent five,
right?
Is in a conflicted position and can't really. I think that's where like you know not to sort of live in a dream world, but like. Having a kind of either strong-willed or charismatic or moral high ground Secretary General. That's where it comes in. Because then he can do things that are not, you know, to say, I wait for the Security Council to tell me what to do, doesn't, you know what I mean?
I think Zimbabwe is a particularly, you know, tough nut to crack. Sure. I think arguably the most sort of charismatic and popular. Secretary General, at least on the African continent, Kofi Annan couldn't get it done.
Well, he did some things in Kenya. At least he tried. I mean, again,
no, he got it done in Kenya. But I'm talking about Zimbabwe is a different, different story.
Right? No. I think I was speaking more generally. Like, it's not just trying to be like negative and say what about Georgia, but it just seems kind of. I don't know. It seems kind of strangely lackadaisical about something that really like portends to be kind of. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is like, what's the UN's role? That's almost like so. There is this kind of standoff and territorial dispute, proxy dispute between the U.S. and Russia in Georgia and South Ossetia. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to defuse it? It's not like President Sarkozy. It's not Gordon Brown. So I don't know. Maybe it can't. Maybe it's just. This is power politics at the top, and both sides will somehow,
They're going to have to come to some sort of, mutually agreeable, solution. I don't think, there's what can sort of the UN sort of General Secretariat do if you have Russia, beating down the door, if you have a Security Council member that's a party to the conflict, it makes their sort of latitude of actions a bit more difficult.
Right. No, it's definitely tricky. But I mean, again, this is just the nitty gritty of last night late. They sent Vijay Nambiar, who's the chief of staff, and he stayed for part of the meeting. Then he left. I said to him like, "What? Why are you leaving?" And he said, "We've done all we can here." But it was like, I don't know, because nothing passed
but
last
like,
night.
What, I mean,
what can they do?
This is actually an honest, not like so. What sort of could they do? They being the UN General Secretary, the staff of the UN.
Well, first things first.
The member states.
Sure. First things like this thing of whether bombs fell in Abkhazia seems pretty important to get those facts. And the UN is a credible reporter, and there's a mission there. They're being paid. You know what I mean? This is what they're supposed to be watching.
I assume they're in their bunkers, you know, trying not to get killed, right?
Right, right. Yeah, no. I mean, I guess, you know, there must...
Are they civilian? Are they military? I think if they are military, there's probably fewer than 100 military.
They always... I mean, they've done reports on all these drone issues. They can do... Again, maybe we've gone on a tangent here. It just seems... Yeah. Actually, I mean, I guess it is interesting. Like, people will say, like, at the UN. In this case, the UN is basically providing the room. That's it. You know what I mean?
And
even that, they're doing badly. Are you ready? Last night was quite comical, because at 1:30 in the morning, after consultations, they came out to have this maybe it was 1, between 1 and 1:30. They go into the Security Council. We're off the clock. Everyone's sitting there, and suddenly the sound system is feeding back. It's like Jimi Hendrix. It's like, it's unbelievable. And so they turn it off, and for like 15 minutes, we're waiting. And it's like, you know, I mean, it's fine with me. I was blogging it like crazy. I'm sure I'll put up the link. But it was like, literally, I mean, it's sort of like you got a lot of the meters running, right? You know, you got like Churkin, the ambassador, you know, and there became some discussion of moving next door to the trusteeship council. Then somehow it was fixed. And I think the idea was like somehow it wasn't amplified right. It was like, well, get a bullhorn, you know, and just do it, you know. But it was in any event, I'm not, you know. I actually do. I want to ask you about your trip. I want to get your feedback on the UN losing money in Myanmar and concealing it. But you tell me how you want to proceed.
Let's go with trip, and then maybe we can circle back to Myanmar next time we talk.
Sure.
So trip. So this week I was traveling with the President Clinton and his entourage through Ethiopia. Where were we? We were in Ethiopia, Rwanda, Liberia, Senegal, and then Mexico City for the big AIDS conference. And I should say, this is perhaps a disclaimer, that the Clinton Foundation paid all my expenses for the trip, and I was blogging on the Huffington Post and on Dispatch. UN Dispatch.
Full disclosure. That's what we do here at Blogging.
And frankly, you know, I would not have been able to afford it myself, because we flew on some pretty fancy planes and stayed at some pretty fancy hotels. That said, it was supposed to be something of a 5-day trip. Mm-hmm. It was condensed into about 3 days because we had significant plane troubles in Newark. Mm-hmm. We were about 2 days delayed in Newark. At least the press plane was. President Clinton and his entourage made it there on time, but they had to juggle around the schedule a bit, to get some press coverage of the events. And it was a fascinating trip. Perhaps for our purposes here, was the most fascinating and interesting for me was the stop in Liberia. And quite literally, as soon as you touch down in the airport outside Monrovia, there's just UN everywhere. There are sort of, you know, UN helicopters as far as the eye can see, humanitarian air service planes. We had, probably because we were sort of in a ex-presidential motorcade, there were UNMIL, the United Nations mission in Lebanon, some like 15,000 strong, were just lining the routes of our trip. And one thing that sort of really stood out was this sort of famous, in our world, all-women foreign police unit.
Sure.
So there's this unit, I guess it's probably a couple, maybe about 1,000. Or less of female police peacekeepers in Liberia, and they're all from India, and they, you know, they're holding their big AK-47s, and they were looking mean, and they were, and you know, it was sort of a nice and interesting sight to see them standing side by side their male counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, we made sort of 3 really quick stops in Liberia. The first was at the site of a new Clinton Foundation project, which is a new hotel that they're trying to build on the road between the airport and the capital. Apparently, after the war there, which killed something like 250,000 people, and which, considering the population, is only like 3.5 million, is a really staggering number.
Mm-hmm.
There are only something like 45 hotel beds, and you know, to to secure investment, you need foreign investors, you need places for them to stay.
Sure.
Hence, they're building this kind of fancy new hotel on the outskirts of Monrovia.
Hotel Clinton? What's it going to be called?
It's called the Golden Key Hotel. It's actually not, it's more Hotel Bob Johnson, who is the founder of BET.
Definitely.
From my understanding is, and I'll put up a link so I don't get the details wrong, is that a couple of years ago, as part of like the Clinton Global Initiative, as part of the Clinton Foundation, the founder of BET, who's a billionaire, mm-hmm. helped start mm-hmm. this thing called the Liberian Economic Development Corporation, mm-hmm. which essentially invests money, as you can imagine, in sort of building up Liberian infrastructure. And it is through this investment corporation, which is primarily Robert Johnson Foundation funded. Mm-hmm. that this sort of investment in this hotel, and I think in other hotels, have been created. So then from that hotel, it was a construction site, because
mm-hmm.
it was still sort of being built. But from the Golden Key Hotel construction site, we traveled on our Unmill motorcade down this main road, and we stopped at a little open-air market where hundreds of cheering kids greeted us. It was actually a really nice sight to see. And it was at sort of a foundation set. They're trying to build up this open air market that I think caters mostly to women and female entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally we stopped at wasn't the presidential palace, because my understanding is the presidential palace, as it were, it's not really a palace, was actually partially damaged in a fire, an electrical fire, a few months ago. So President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, is sort of her office is now at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So we went there for an event with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf,
mm-hmm.
And there was an announcement. Let's see if I can get this right. Of the Clinton Foundation managed to secure a price reduction in a certain anti-malaria drug, and they were announcing sort of that price reduction and sort of new distribution methods of that anti-malaria drug throughout Liberia. And that was on a Sunday afternoon. So it's an interesting bit of color.
Mm-hmm.
So I said that the trip was all sort of... A lot of the trip had to get rearranged because of the plane troubles we had.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that sort of our meeting our stop in Liberia was supposed to be, I think, either on a Friday or a Saturday. It happened on a Sunday. And so they had all these sort of Liberian politicians that... came from, you know, pretty much all over, you know, the countryside to sit in this room. And Ellen Johnson Sirleaf made a crack that it's sort of the first time she's ever seen any Liberian politician working on a Sunday.
All right.
But, you know, I came away, again, very impressed with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, I think, as people tend to be.
No, people absolutely. Her reputation here is she's enormous.
The only female African head of state, you know, Harvard trained.
Definitely.
So I don't know, I'm rambling, but I came away, you know,
no,
Liberia was a really fascinating stop, I think.
Sure.
For our purposes.
But what was I guess what I'm saying is, were these projects that, was the goal, was in fact, in a way, your function of publicizing it? What was the goal of the trip, or was it to, like, for him to get his hands dirty? What were things announced? What was the...
You know, a lot were announced. I mean, I was one of... There's a bunch of traveling press. I mean, AB, you know, the big, I guess, interview, the big thing to come out of it, and what you see on the news is ABC News in Liberia, where they asked him, you know, about sort of current political issues.
Sure.
But, you know, the goal... So, you know, he has his foundation, and mm-hmm. he goes to Africa apparently every year. And to check up on his foundation's sort of projects, and the projects we visited ranged from sort of a farm in Rwanda that had been previously destroyed by some sort of crop disease,
mm-hmm.
Sort of some disease that ravaged crops, to visiting HIV/AIDS clinics.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, one of the big sort of themes of the trip, and this is kind of something I took away from it, was that a lot of what his foundation and a lot of what I think the donor community in general nowadays is trying to do in terms of public health in Africa is focus more on strengthening sort of public health infrastructures,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to targeting specific diseases like AIDS, TB,
mm-hmm.
and malaria.
Mm-hmm.
So I think from my understanding is that for most of the last, say, 10 years, most money and most projects in the international donor community have been geared towards fighting specific diseases, namely the big three of AIDS, sure. TB, and malaria.
Yep.
But like the new sort of trend and the new wave in global public health is to not focus on the diseases as much as sort of the delivery, the health delivery sure. mechanisms or the health systems,
yep.
and, you know, like training nurses, training doctors. Actually, I had an interview on UN Plaza a few months ago with this guy, Joel Salonicchio, who is trying to train public health workers on how to use a cell phone device mm-hmm. to enter health data
mm-hmm.
and to, you know, create sort of public health databases. So sure. things like that, as opposed to,
right, to just
focusing specifically on a disease.
Sure, sure. Were you yeah. there when – I mean, this is going to show, the different way we – this is probably a kind of a hype issue, but were you there when Rwanda came out with a study with a report charging France with direct involvement in the 94 genocide?
I didn't, but I heard something about that. You want to maybe elaborate?
Yeah. I was actually yeah. wondering if it had – because it's here it set off sort of you know, shockwaves. That
yeah.
I mean, people always have sort of known that that in the Security Council, not to be Johnny One Note on that, you know, that
yeah.
the U.S. in particular, Madeleine Albright during her tenure, but also
yeah.
that you know, blocked sort of any attempt to stop the killing. But
yeah.
Since then, things have gotten very contentious between the current government of Rwanda and France, in that
yeah.
a French judge essentially accused the current president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, of
yeah.
of having, as a then RPF rebel,
yeah.
been behind the shooting down of the plane of the president, which led to the genocide. So that's a pretty explosive charge. I can't say
yeah.
they've ever proved it. It's an interesting theory, but it's one that obviously has angered Rwanda to the extent that it's almost incontrovertible that France, one, initially sided with, funded, and supported the majority Hutu government leading up to the
yeah.
to the genocide. It's also incontrovertible that after the genocide began, and finally the minority Tutsi RPF forces were able to
mm-hmm.
chase the majority out of the capital, that France then sent in troops largely to kind of help the getaway, basically. I mean, that's how it was
okay.
viewed as – it was viewed as they did – and France's defense to these more recent charges is that they were the only outside force that sent in troops. But the problem is, by the time they sent in troops, the people they were protecting were in many ways the perpetrators, who are then fleeing into the Congo. But Rwanda has gone to some expense to create to put together a report that says French troops themselves were engaged in rape and killing. And this is highly explosive. And I think France is like, doesn't really know what to do. And I think, you know, Rwanda, again, they're not, they don't, like, unlike Spain, they don't have universal jurisdiction. I don't think they're going to say, you know, we're going to put Alain Juppé. They've named, like, François Mitterrand, Balladur, a slew of French politicians
yeah.
as being war criminals. And
yeah.
the thing is that obviously the Rwandan government has a certain moral high ground because they largely represent the victims of the genocide. So,
yeah.
and the other, I mean, the reason, and something that we've talked about before, maybe we can, in a way, some people, cynics will say, in part, the timing is that Rwanda has this general who's the number two in the Sudan peacekeeping mission that's been charged with war crimes by Spanish
yeah.
court. And Rwanda's very mad about this. It's their position, number one, that he didn't do it, but two, that as sort of the minority Tutsi forces, whatever they did was self-defense. And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can't – they've made a big point of saying that the International Criminal Court for Rwanda cannot put – they don't say Tutsis per se, cannot put RPF on trial, and even
yeah.
hasn't. So there's this whole – that's the response, but in a weird way, them coming out with this report saying that France, you know, systemically it was part of genocide, is very helpful to Sudan, right? Do you see what I'm saying? I'm going to hand it off there. Given that the Sudanese president has now is marching toward an indictment for war crimes and genocide, the fact that one of the marchers and one of the countries pointing the finger and saying, you know, we can't accept impunity, is itself charged by you know, in some people's eyes, the most credible
yeah.
African country with war crimes and genocide. Kind of, I mean, I almost wonder, like, what
yeah.
as an international justice guy, what do you think? What do you make of all this?
Well, I mean, again, I think there are two sort of. On the one hand, you have an institution,
mm-hmm.
the International Criminal Court,
mm-hmm.
who's making these charges and has, you know, shown based on sort of evidence that they've gathered as part of like a criminal prosecution. You know, it's part of like a criminal process. It's not
right.
just like an accusation being lobbed
mm-hmm.
On the one hand versus an accusation being lobbed on the other hand. And I don't know, like, I don't see how you say that the Rwandan government is sort of one of the most credible voices on this. Okay. I mean, you look at what they're doing in Congo, Eastern Congo. I'd say it's pretty far from.
No,
from,
they say, I'm glad, actually, because I think I may have said that a bit tongue-in-cheek. I think that they're perceived that way. I think that they're, I don't know, maybe I'm moving weird circles. I know people that are sort of, maybe it's just guilt. Maybe it's guilt from the genocide that people don't want to say, like, you're out of control. I know that in the elections there, I actually did some, like, freedom of information requests. In the most recent elections there, the people that say, I want to represent the Hutu majority are not allowed to say the word Hutu. Can't run. There's a lot of kind of First Amendment problems there, but I wouldn't. I mean,
they don't have the. They're not. They don't have the First Amendment.
Right. No, I understand. I've used that. I should have said free speech. I mean, I think freedom of election.
Sorry. Like, I don't mean to be so.
Oh yeah, no. I meant that loosely. I understand they don't have. No. But I mean, I think even. I mean, I think what in terms of Eastern Congo. I mean, I'm actually very. I mean, their position is, they have only in '96, and this is actually what the guy, the general. Who's now number two in the Sudan peacekeeping mission is charged with, is in like 96, things got very fast and loose where they went into the Eastern Congo and sort of, they pretty much like drove on the capital and some resources went missing. I think currently what Rwanda would say is their only interest in Eastern Congo is that the remnants of the genocidal forces, the FDLR, not be given safe haven there. And I guess what I'm saying is I think most people that I know think that's a pretty... If you have a reason to go across the border, that might be one of them, trying to capture people that slaughtered.
But I think the argument now is that they're using that as a pretext to exploit the bountiful natural resources.
I'm surprised to hear you.
I recall reading, and again, actually, in a previous UN Plaza with the filmmaker Lisa Jackson, who made that film about rape in the Congo, she made the point, and it's a point I've seen made earlier, that at one point the mineral coal, the world's largest exporter of the mineral coltan, which is used in cell phones and iPods, in their batteries, was the Rwanda. Now, the irony being that there is no coltan to be found in Rwanda, and that most of the world's coltan is in eastern DRC.
Yep. No.
I am no apologist for the government.
Well done. No, but I guess what I wonder about these trips too.
It was a fascinating and on the one hand, I think sort of perhaps Rwanda's foreign policy is a bit it leaves a lot to be desired.
I think
at the same time, in the country itself, from my personal impression, was that from the statistics I've read. Its sort of national GDP increased something like fourfold in the last 10 years.
Right.
It is, again, to the extent that you can get a great impression of a country, staying in a hotel for 2 days, and being as part of like a presidential, entourage.
Sure.
Although we did go out into rural, we took a couple helicopters to some really rural villages. In both eastern Rwanda and northern Rwanda, and that was actually a fascinating trip excursion. But it seemed to me that it was a country on the mend.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very and again we came there, so we went from Ethiopia to Rwanda, and the difference was staggering. In terms of just like general. Put togetherness of the country. Rwanda seems sort of there and very close to getting there. Ethiopia seemed to still have a bit of a way to go.
Sure.
Again, to the extent that I could sort of make this judgment based on spending a day in the country
and
being a part of again like a presidential entourage.
Let me be even more outrageous. We'll trade stories. In that Security Council trip earlier this summer. I'll second you based on only a nighttime bus ride through Rwanda because the UN plane was shot from inside in eastern Congo in Goma. The difference just in terms of like roads and signage and like street lights.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently, and again there was I saw no garbage on the side of the road in Rwanda. Apparently they have sort of one Saturday a month. Is sort of like a community service day, and they just and it's just
yeah, no, no,
it's, clean.
It's, No, no, exactly. You know what I think it is? I just wanted to, because I want to clarify one thing. You're right. I don't know why I was saying, like, one of the most credible or one of the most respected. I will say, like, just to the inside the UN, their ambassador is given a lot of leeway. Like, he'll say some hard, and I think it really is guilt. So I take that back. I don't think that, and this may almost be limited to, like, inside the confines of UN headquarters, but they're treated with a degree of kind of deference, and I think it is, and maybe it's appropriate too. That is it's a country that sort of bristles because it's like, I mean, every argument can be ended with the Trump card of, like, what did you do in 1994? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think, for example, this, by all means, most people would think that now that this guy who's the number two in the UN peacekeeping mission in Darfur is accused in a pretty serious way of war crimes, probably he should either step down or not be reappointed. But Rwanda has said, if you don't reappoint him, we're pulling our guys. And they're going to probably reappoint him. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I do want, here's one thing, because it's been too long since we've engaged on the Darfur issue, since you've been away. There's been a little scuttlebutt. I mean, there's obviously things always happen. Many things have happened. There was the indictment. There was the UN Global Compact canceled its. It was going to have a meeting in Sudan for countries of how to. I don't know what they would have said, but how to engage in a responsible way with the Sudanese companies, economy. They canceled that due to fear of violence after the indictment moves toward indictment by Ocampo. But there's been a little UN side story here of. What is Ban Ki-moon's approach toward President Bashir of Sudan? And it emerged after a series of off-the-record lunches, which he did with certain reporters here. One of the reporters, rightly or wrongly, wrote a story immediately after the lunch saying Ban Ki-moon has been advised to distance himself from President Bashir, Van Aids said, and he will do so. So,
did this reporter violate the terms lunch?
Well, here we go. Funny thing is, like the next day, I asked the spokeswoman. So it's been reported by the newspaper Al Hayat that Ban Ki-moon has been advised by his legal advisors to distance himself from Bashir. Is it true or false? And she said, even if he got that advice, he doesn't have to take it. And afterwards, innumerable people came up to me and said, yeah, that was said at the lunch. Yes, it was outrageous that it was reported. So it sort of like hit this weird kind of vein. The reality is it's possible it could be off the record and then the person could like immediately after the lunch call Ban Aids and get the same thing on that basis, right? But the weird thing is, and this is where I want to sort of, rather than like, it's not a critique of reporters. I think it was interesting, I thought. But the reality is like, if in fact Ban has gotten that advice and has agreed to take it, that as the figurehead of the UN system, he should distance himself from President Bashir. And I want to know if you think he should. If he's going to do that, why announce it in an off-the-record lunch? Okay, go.
Well, it's not exactly announcing it if it's off the record, man.
That's what I'm saying.
The point.
I
think you have to trust the reporters to be professional enough.
Okay, but why say it to reporters off the record? Here we go. That's my question to you. If you're going to take a moral stand, why do it in secret? And if you're going to do it in secret, why tell anyone?
Well, you know, I don't presume to get in the head of sort of Ban Ki-moon's press.
Presuming. I'm going to presume.
You know, any reason any politician, anyone wants to give an off-the-record briefing, it's to, you know, give the reporters some inside information that you don't necessarily want attributed to you at that moment.
Right, but usually it's about other people, not about yourself.
Maybe, you know, in future times you could report it,
right?
You know, we had some off the record state, you know, sessions with the president, but you know.
So what did he say, Mark?
Yeah.
What did his aide say?
Aide say.
Is he distancing himself from President Al-Bashir?
It never came up actually.
Okay. What does he think of the indictment? That should have come up. Come on.
Didn't come up. I wanted to ask him, but never got the chance.
I'm not
in an interview.
Far be it from me to be critical. I think that's a really
no. Like that's the question on my mind.
How about Joey Cheek? Let's keep moving.
Yeah. Well. Okay. So let's make this our last little thing.
Okay. I don't know if this is an item. Actually, I mean, if you have more, to me that's it. There with how about Joey Cheek? But we can unpack.
So I think Joey Cheek is the gold medal speed skater from the 2004 Olympics, who was one of the early and outspoken Darfur advocates in the country, frankly.
Sure.
he got on sort of the Darfur bandwagon early, and to his great credit, helped raise awareness and started this operation called Team Darfur, which is essentially a group of athletes seeking to raise awareness about, you know, the situation in Darfur. And he got his visa revoked from the Chinese government. Yep. And that's, yeah, I don't know if there's much more to say.
I asked for any Ban Ki-moon comment on it. There was none. We don't comment on that. Because there's, you know, there, obviously things are a little
it's a little testy.
A little testy, but it seemed like that's. Yeah. I mean, in a way, that's like it's like a litmus test. And then the U.S. mission obviously was all over it and said, you know, we support Mr. Chi. I think when it was first said, I knew a lot of people that were like they've barred an eligible athlete from attending the Olympics due to his politics, and it's like, well, no, he's a winter athlete. So, but still in all, it's like sort of, you know, it doesn't look good It was just sort of, it's interesting, like, I mean, I think what over here is that it's, this is why I think, like, the thing, like you were saying with Clinton, it's like, almost on a daily basis, things take place regarding Sudan, which it's a matter of, like, okay, so what does the UN have to say about this, right? Like, since, you know, the African Union and the Organization of the Islamic Conference have both said the indictment should be frozen because Sudan should set up its own legal process to consider crimes in Darfur. And they recently named a special prosecutor. So it seems fair to say, okay, do you believe in that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And why? So why am I saying this? Because the UN's position is, we're not going to comment on every little thing. But it's like, okay, but you kind of have, at what point you've said, like, he should turn them over. They've said they have their own prosecutor. So is the prosecutor they appointed, you know, totally not credible? If he's not, great, then say it. Anyway. Mm-hmm. We'll see. I think this is a, you know, sadly, it's a story that has many legs to it.
Well, we'll have to revisit it.
I'm sure
we will. It's getting steamy in my recording studio.
Oh, okay, here. No.
I'm going to have to turn off the air conditioning. I have to turn off the air conditioning. Makes so much noise.
Here's my last statement to you. I need to turn it off when I record. This is a litmus test station.
Yeah.
While you were away, Ban Ki-moon decided to turn up the heat at the UN, 5 degrees Fahrenheit, in order to save the climate. Your view?
Oh, man, that's rough.
Oh, come on. Have I finally got... You think it's a joke? Come on.
I think I feel bad for you.
I think UN Dispatch was all over it. They love it. They love it.
Cool. Oh, really?
I think so. But mostly because they're not in the building.
It was weird. I was in a news bubble. I didn't really know what was going on.
No, but that's why I think it's good. I want to catch you when you first come back before you get... I don't want to say anyone's giving you talking points, Mark. I just want to say I'm taking that as an admission that you think it's a ludicrous and lame... At InterCity Press.
Hey, I'm glad I don't work there.
I don't mean to be self-serving.
I can imagine it's uncomfortable.
There are people. There are people fanning themselves here. A little.
But it's. I think a noble and a. You know, to the extent that the UN is sort of a global. You know, on the global vanguard of things like this, I think it's probably an important symbolic move.
It would be more noble if Ban Ki-moon weren't going on a 2-week vacation starting tomorrow, and it was a 1-month test.
Yes,
it might be viewed as more. And I want
to. Well, for what's worth, you know, August is the emptiest month in the UN.
Sure.
So.
Oh no, I'm not saying. Right. Definitely.
Until we chat again, sir.
Okay.
All right.
Bye,
Matthew.
Welcome
Thanks.
back.
Thank you. Well, talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye.